The little boy runs down the farm lane, pausing briefly to turn and wave goodbye to his grandmother. Within minutes, he's distracted from his task, lured into a game. But soon, he understands that this is no game, and these are not his friends. A built-in instinct to flee kicks in, but it's too late, and the game has already turned deadly. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 150, The Murder of Isaac Michels. This episode is sponsored by the upcoming release movie Mother's Instinct. They call a husband who's lost his wife a widower, and a wife who's lost her husband a widow. But there is no name for the loss of a child, because it's a level of grief no single word can describe. Celine and Alice are living seemingly perfect lives. They both have successful husbands and a young son each. Their bond appears unbreakable. But when tragedy strikes and one experiences the worst loss imaginable, everything unravels before their eyes. Celine, played by Anne Hathaway, and Alice, played by Jessica Chastain, find themselves and their families lost in a whirlpool of grief, guilt, suspicion, and paranoia neither seems capable of escaping from. Mother's Instinct opens in cinemas in South Africa on Friday, 12 April, and, TCSA listeners, I've got two sets of double tickets to give away to watch Mother's Instinct, as well as double refreshment tickets for your popcorn and a drink. You just can't miss this, so make sure you enter the giveaway on True Crime South Africa's social platforms right after you've listened to this episode. A huge thank you to Mother's Instinct for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Ian Martinsich, Kirsty for Mark, Ruan Mankies, Paula Tuck, Jenna Leroux, and someone who clearly took me up on the Make Me Say Weird Things on the Podcast Challenge, Seymour Butts. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support is greatly appreciated. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be airing quite a few of the earlier Patreon episodes here in the True Crime South Africa feed. Doing this is going to help me catch up on a backlog I've got building and also create a stash of new episodes for future. Those who are Patreon members may have heard these episodes before, Some will have a few changes as I find additional information and update my knowledge, so they're worth listening to again. Because some of these episodes were recorded up to 3 years ago, the sound is sometimes different, so I've re-recorded them so they sound less like Nicole from 2021. Today's case is a child victim, and the perpetrator is also a child. So there are very few resources available about the case because minor offenders' identities are protected by law. In researching this episode, I used the book Bad Kids by Chris Carsten, as well as the few media articles I could find. So let's get into episode 150, The Murder of Isaac Michels.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Isaac Michels was born in 1995 to Elsabie and Jacobus Michels. The family, which included Isaac's three siblings, lived on the Cape Flats. In the same year that Isaac was born, a series of murders of young boys was seemingly brought to an end by the arrest of a neighbour of the Michels, Norman Simons. Simons would only ever be convicted of one of the murders in that series and was recently released on parole, but the series of horrific murders had made parents think twice about how safe their children were. Of course, most parents believed that these dangers were only prevalent in the city. Surely, the farmlands surrounding the city of Cape Town would not be home to such atrocities. It was for this reason that Isaac would be sent to a farm in Fore for the December holidays in 2003. The farm, nestled among the Helderberg Mountains, is less than half an hour's drive from Isaac's parents' home, and both his maternal and paternal grandmothers lived on the farm. Isaac's paternal grandmother, Hessie Michels, and his maternal grandmother, Sarah Jenker, were seasonal workers on the farm and lived with a community of farm workers in housing provided for them. As the school year had come to an end, Isaac had done so well in grade 2 that his parents decided to let him spend the holidays at the farm. He would be well looked after with two grandmothers, Molly, coddling him, and the grandmothers were very excited to have their grandson visit. Isaac was very small for his age, so he'd earned the family nickname Kleinkind, which is Afrikaans for small child. It's also a reference term for grandchild in the Afrikaans language, but in this case, the name had definitely sprung from Isaac's small stature. Isaac arrived at the farm shortly after schools had closed for the year. He would split his time between Granny Hessie's home and Granny Sarah's home, which were within walking distance of one another. There were several children living on the farm as well, grandchildren visiting for the holidays like Isaac, and also children of the farm workers that lived there. Isaac was certainly not at risk of being bored, and he would often wake up early, grab a cup of tea and a sandwich for breakfast, and be out the door and playing before the grandmother he was with could even wipe the sleep out of her eyes. The farm was safe. Isaac had no worries to speak of. The only thing his grannies had cautioned him on was the farm's dam. The murky waters held certain danger for a city boy like Isaac, who'd never learned to swim. On Friday, the 5th of December 2003, Isaac was at Granny Sarah's home. He excitedly told her that he would need to leave early the next day to go to Granny Hessie because she was taking him to town to buy new shoes for Christmas. Granny Sarah would report how Isaac had played around the house that night until his bedtime, and then he'd slept through the night until the early hours of Saturday morning. Sarah's last memory of her grandson is how he wolfed down his breakfast on Saturday the 6th of December before he ran out the door and headed over to Granny Hesse for the shopping trip. Isaac Michels would not make it to Granny Hesse's house that morning, though. Instead, on the way, he came across three young boys he'd become friendly with, and they convinced him to go play with them at the dam. When Isaac didn't turn up at her house for the shopping trip as arranged, Hesse was not immediately concerned. He was an 8-year-old boy on a farm, after all, and he'd probably either decided to extend his stay with his other grandmother or something else had caught his attention. Hesse figured they could always go into town the next day and get the shoes. On Sunday morning, when Isaac still had not arrived at her house, Hesse walked over to Sarah's house to find out what her grandson's plans were. Sarah, of course, was very surprised when Hesse turned up on her doorstep, and very soon the two women figured out that neither one knew where little Isaac was, and the last confirmed sighting of the boy was 24 hours before. The pair started to rouse neighbours, and soon a small search party was getting ready to search the surrounding farmlands and homes. Before they could set out, though, a young boy came running up to them hysterically shouting that Isaac was lying dead in the dam. The throng of people ran to the dam and found the small body of Isaac Michels floating in amongst reeds near the shore. Chaos erupted on the quiet farm. Police arrived soon after being called and cordoned off the area, hoping to preserve whatever evidence they could. Isaac's body was retrieved by divers, and he was officially pronounced dead. Despite the scene seeming like a tragic drowning, it had to be treated with care, and a full investigation would have to be undertaken into exactly how Kleinkind had ended up in the dam. Any unnatural death triggers a full death investigation, and the results of what police find in the investigation will determine whether charges need to be laid in terms of homicide or any other level of culpability in the death. An unnatural death investigation should be as complete as a murder investigation because at the starting point, you don't really know what you're dealing with, and mistakes made in the early hours could mean evidence lost, which could lead to a failure to get justice for a victim. Police started to interview the residents of the farm, starting with the three boys that had become friendly with Isaac. The boys were children of workers on the farm and aged 7, 9, and 10. The boys said that they had been playing at the dam with Isaac on Saturday morning, but they'd gone off to do other things and left him there. They hadn't seen him after that. Everyone on the farm was in shock, so police had to take that into account when they interviewed the three boys and observed their behaviour. The boys appeared highly strung and nervous, but with such young children, this could easily be as a result of the trauma of losing their young friend. When Isaac's body was pulled from the dam, he had foam coming from his mouth. This is an indication of drowning and is caused by the mixing of inhaled water with a natural soapy substance in the lungs that helps to maintain the stability of air sacs in those organs. If this is noted in an autopsy, as it was in Isaac's, it's one indicator that drowning is a possible cause of death. But such foam is also present in other causes of death, such as poisoning and death following a seizure. Another indicator of possible drowning is the presence of significant amounts of water in the stomach and lungs, which sometimes happens when people drown. The absence of water does not count drowning out, though, and the presence of it does not determine whether the victim drowned by accident or through the involvement of others. As I mentioned in an earlier episode, bodies of water, the presence of water in the lungs is also not a definitive indicator of drowning, because water can be forced into the lung cavity simply through the process of a body floating in water for some time. So the individual may have been killed before they were placed in the water, even if water is found in the lungs. When Chris Carsten wrote the book Bad Kids, it was widely believed that the presence of diatoms in various organs in the body, including the brain, was a definitive indicator of drowning if you could match those diatoms to those in the body of water the person was found in. Since his publication, this theory has been proven to be inaccurate. Diatoms are microscopic single-celled algae organisms, and when this theory was being used by pathologists to prove drowning, it was not yet known that diatoms are actually everywhere, not just in water. They're in the air we breathe, and they are already in our body. Because the algae is so simple in structure, it's not possible to categorically differentiate between those present in different bodies of water and those already present in our body. Those same diatoms may also be present in the air around the body of water and could just be breathed in. When Isaac Michel's autopsy was conducted, though, the diatom theory was still in practice, and the presence of diatoms was noted in his organs. Isaac's skin had also started to wrinkle, which indicated he'd been in the water for more than 12 hours. Marks and bruising were noted around Isaac's throat and on the back of his neck during this autopsy, but it was believed that he may have injured himself while struggling to get out of the water. The findings of the autopsy were that Isaac Michels had died due to drowning and that the circumstances were likely accidental. Isaac's devastated family prepared to lay the young boy to rest and started planning his funeral. Just 3 days after Isaac's death, though, on Wednesday, the 10th of December 2003, a passing remark by one of Isaac's playmates would take this case from one of a tragic accident to a horror beyond belief. The 10-year-old boy, who had admitted to having played with Isaac on the morning of his death, mentioned an argument that he, the 9-year-old and the 7-year-old boy, had had with Isaac that Saturday morning. The boy said Isaac had insulted their mothers, so they'd hit him. This was the first mention of any violence toward Isaac Michels before his death, and the woman to whom the child made this statement could not keep the information to herself. She went over to Hesse's house and told the grieving grandmother of this new development. Hesse immediately phoned Isaac's father, Jacobus, who in turn contacted police and insisted that a second autopsy be conducted on his son before they buried him. This mention of violence made Jacobus think of the injuries to his son's throat. The injuries had been dismissed as likely having been caused by his struggle for life in the water, but what if those injuries were actually caused by a struggle of a different kind? Police agreed that a second autopsy was necessary. This more comprehensive autopsy would show that Isaac Michels' skull was fractured and there was bleeding on his brain as a result. His Adam's apple was crushed and there were injuries to his face, which were consistent with being struck. The Adam's apple in males sits just below the hyoid bone, which is the bone that is sometimes broken during strangulation. There is no mention of whether Isaac's hyoid bone was also broken, but his Adam's apple was noted as being crushed. The autopsy determined that the injuries would likely have left Isaac unconscious but still breathing. If he was left with these injuries for a significant period, they could have caused his death. The crushing of the Adam's apple alone would have caused significant swelling in his throat, making it more and more difficult to breathe as the minutes ticked past. Despite these injuries, though, it was the fact that Isaac had been placed in the water while unconscious that had caused his death. As Isaac would not have been able to stand up and walk into the water himself after receiving these injuries, someone had to have put him in the dam. Police were now no longer investigating an unnatural death due to accidental drowning. This was quite clearly a case of murder. As police started to re-interview the three boys, they would soon find that there was no clear narrative about the events of that day. Each boy had a slightly different story, but from the injuries, the evidence at the scene, and witness accounts of the three boys' movements that day, a picture of sorts did start to emerge. As Isaac was on his way to his grandmother's house that morning, his three friends convinced him to come and play with them at the dam. They'd played quite happily for a little while, but then a verbal argument broke out, and soon the three boys who lived on the same property were facing off against Isaac, who was essentially an outsider. Some of the boys said that the physical altercation started when Isaac had made disparaging remarks about their mothers. It appeared that the 10-year-old struck first, picking up a rock and striking Isaac on the head. The 9-year-old then picked up a plank and hit Isaac in the throat and face. The 7-year-old said he'd felt compelled to do something too, so he punched Isaac in the nose. The boys said that at this point they thought Isaac may be dead. He was lying very still on the ground, and the boys claimed to have been terrified. They fled to a nearby industrial park where they would sometimes play on weekends. From this point, there are further differing accounts from the boys as to what happened next. In one account, the boys came up with the rest of the plan themselves. There was speculation, however, that they had confided in an adult, and it was this unknown adult that had given them the idea about covering their tracks, or perhaps even that unknown adult who did it for them. Either way, at dusk on that Saturday night, the three boys returned to the dam. They loaded Isaac's body into a rubber dinghy and rowed out to the middle of the dam. They then rolled him out of the boat and into the water, and as they watched the murky waters envelop their victim, they hoped he would stay at the bottom of the dam forever. Early the next morning, as murmurs on the farm began around missing Isaac Michels, the three boys returned to the dam, unable to stay away from the scene of their crime. To their horror, they found his body washed up on the side, out in the open. They dragged his body into the reeds, where he was later discovered by a child that had not been involved in the incident. The horror of the reality of what had happened dawned on Isaac's parents, the occupants of the farm, and South Africa as a whole. Three boys, all 10 years old and younger, had been responsible for the death of another. Had his death been as a result of a normal skirmish among young boys, where he'd perhaps slipped and fallen into the dam and drowned, the story would be very different. But the level of violence inflicted upon Isaac went way beyond a punch-up between boys. Weapons were used. Excessive force was used. And then, chillingly, the boys had seemingly come up with a rather cold-blooded plan to cover up their act. And therein lay another question. What of the talk that an adult had advised the children? The police and Isaac's father did not believe it was possible for children of this age to have hatched such a plan and carried it out on their own. But two cases, one in South Africa and another in the UK, would cast serious doubt on this belief. In 1993, in Liverpool, England, 2 10-year-old boys lured 2-year-old Jamie Bulger from a butcher's shop in a shopping centre. His mother had looked away for just a minute to pay for her purchase, and when she looked back, her son was gone. Little Jamie would be found 2 days later on a railway line not far from where he went missing. The toddler had suffered 42 injuries to his body and face, and there were indications he'd been sexually molested. The two 10-year-old perpetrators in that case had intentionally placed Jamie's body on the railway track so that it would look like an accident. The child was indeed struck by a train after his death. The case revolted and terrified the world when it happened, and at the time, British authorities took the decision that the boys could be held accountable for their actions, and they were detained in a juvenile facility for an indeterminate period. Both boys were released in 2001 and given new identities to avoid public backlash. Then, after Isaac's murder, yet another incident, this time much closer to home, would force South Africans to admit that children of this age could indeed commit such horrendous actions. In April 2004, 12-year-old Ashwell Joseph went missing in Balhar. He was last determined to have been in the company of three friends, all under the age of 12. The boys had indicated they'd last seen Ashwell at a nearby dam. When police went to search the area, Ashwell's body surfaced. It would emerge that the group of boys had been sniffing glue at the dam, and Ashwell had allegedly inhaled too much and slipped into unconsciousness. The boys said that they'd been concerned they would get into trouble because they were sure their friend was dead, so they'd devised a plan to dump him in the dam to make it look like a drowning. Both of these cases seem to prove that it was indeed possible for children of that age to develop such schemes on their own and carry them out. A common theme among many of these child perpetrators was that they had come from homes where substance abuse or domestic violence was present. They also lived in communities where both these issues were prevalent. As the prosecuting authority laboured over what to do with these three boys, another question came to the fore. In each of the other cases I've mentioned, there was a strong leader in the group, one child that seemed to make more decisions and initiate the violence. So who was that leader among the three responsible for Isaac's murder? Did that child hold more culpability than the others, or was it a case of pack mentality where one started in on the child and everyone else just mindlessly followed without direction? In 2004, it was decided not to proceed with any criminal charges against the three boys. Instead, their parents agreed to have the boys attend corrective and rehabilitative courses as set out by the prosecutor. The parents and primary caregivers of the boys were also ordered to attend rehabilitation programs to deal with issues in those families that had been unearthed during the investigation. The ruling also included a victim-offender dialogue with Isaac's family, in which they would be allowed to ask any questions they wanted answered. A few months after this ruling was given, the media released information about possible charges against the father of one of the boys, but there was no further development around this. Essentially, the prosecutor had decided that there was nothing to be gained from criminally prosecuting the boys. The varying accounts of what had happened left too much undetermined, and everyone would be better off if the boys were not separated from their families. The psychologist testified at a hearing that it was very difficult to really understand what had been going through the minds of the three boys that day. She says that one option is that they could have thought it was a fantasy game, and she says, quote, "or one of the boys with a personality disorder could have played a leading role in the events," end quote. So, that tells us that at least one of the boys involved in the death of Isaac Michels was possibly found to have traits of a personality disorder. And that is very interesting, because today a psychologist would not be likely to make such a statement about a child of 10 years and younger having a personality disorder. In general, personality disorders are diagnosed after the age of 18, as your personality is still developing even after that point. When you're 10, it's definitely not fully developed. It is, of course, possible to see indicators of personality disorders at that age, so either the psychologist felt that there was already more than sufficient evidence to point to such a disorder in one of the boys, which is a scary thought, or she should have phrased her statement differently and said that one of the boys with indicators of a possible personality disorder may have played a leading role in the event. I personally don't put much stock in the idea that the children thought this was some sort of game. None of the children had implied that in their statements. When Isaac became unconscious, they stated they thought he was dead. They knew that they would get into trouble for causing his death, so they tried to hide their actions. Surely if they'd thought it was a game, they would have left Isaac there and perhaps believed he would somehow magically come back to life. In my opinion, they displayed an understanding of the permanence of their actions. Another reference to personality disorders was made by the same psychologist when she was asked about the possibility of rehabilitation in child offenders. She says, quote, "If a child is a sociopath, moral development does not occur as it should, and it is incredibly difficult to rehabilitate him," end quote. In the case of the two boys convicted of murdering Jamie Bulger, after their release at the age of 18, one of the boys, John Venables, continued to offend. He has been convicted of drug possession as well as twice convicted and paroled on possession of child abuse material. On each occasion of his conviction, he's been issued with a brand new identity at significant cost to British taxpayers. The other boy, Robert Thompson, has never reoffended, to our knowledge, of course, and is reported to be in a long-term relationship with a partner who is aware of his true identity. If we are interested in determining which type of child would be a leader in this sort of act, I'm sure you, like me, would assume that Venables had taken the lead in Jamie's murder because he's committed additional offences against children since then. But we would both be wrong. At the time, and even in the ensuing period, it's believed that Robert Thompson was actually the main perpetrator in the crime. So perhaps it actually means very little which of the three boys was mostly responsible for Isaac's murder, and perhaps it also doesn't really matter which one of them was said to have suffered from a personality disorder. If Robert Thompson is anything to go by, perhaps it is possible to rehabilitate violent child offenders. I feel like there's so much that we don't know about this case. If you look at the Jamie Bulger case, I have to wonder if Isaac was not perhaps also lured away to that dam on that Saturday morning. Had the three boys decided they didn't like this outsider, and did they maybe want to teach him a lesson of some sort? Was this event less of a tragic miscalculation of a young mind and actually more of a preconceived, calculated series of events? I don't think that any one of the boys had premeditated the murder of Isaac, but was he perhaps lured to the dam with the intention of beating him? Unfortunately, it seems that these boys' families were also deeply stuck in a common cycle of substance use disorders, and it's likely they would have been seeing some domestic violence as a result. This type of extended exposure to violence as a child can result in children being desensitized and more likely to commit violent acts themselves. There's another case I'd really like to cover at some point, and that involves the youngest known serial killer in South Africa, a case from the west coast of the Western Province. But that case, like this one, and any others with child offenders, has very little information available because the identities of child offenders are protected by law. There's also been a move to ensure that the identities of child offenders remain protected for the rest of their natural lives. Before this, we've seen offenders' names being revealed in the media as soon as they turn 18, and this seems set to change in South Africa. The Child Justice Act is quite an interesting topic on its own, and I'd like to get an expert onto the podcast to discuss it and the most recent changes in more detail. In its current form, the Child Justice Act has been in force since 2010. Before that, child offenders were dealt with under the Criminal Procedure Act, which also dealt with adult offenders. It's important to keep in mind that when Isaac was murdered, this act was not in place, but the offenders were still dealt with in a similar way to what the current Act allows. The very basic tenets of the Act state that a child under the age of 10 years old cannot be arrested. This means that a child under 10 does not have criminal capacity and cannot be charged or arrested for an offence. In such a case, the child will be referred to the Children's Court. A child older than 10 but younger than 14 is presumed to lack criminal capacity unless the state proves that he or she has criminal capacity. Such a child can be arrested. A child above 14 but under 18 is said to have criminal capacity and can be arrested. Diversion is the key outcome for child offenders under the Child Justice Act, and this can take various forms depending on the seriousness of the offence. In the most serious of cases, such as rape and murder, where premeditation or extreme violence is used, direct imprisonment is an option, but only for offenders over the age of 14. I absolutely understand why child offenders are dealt with differently than adult offenders, and if there's ever a time when rehabilitation is possible, it's most certainly at such a young age. I can only hope that this leg of the correction system is handled better than some others, because it's really absolutely vital. I don't know what it is about child offenders that's so scary. Is it the possibility of what someone who can commit a cold-blooded crime as a child might be capable of when they grow up? Is the witnessing of the complete polar opposite of what we see as the innocence of children versus the deep perversion of taking a human life all rolled into one person that makes it far too difficult to comprehend? I don't know. I just know there's something different about this. Something in my gut that I don't feel when I talk about adult offenders. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I guess the thing to keep in mind is that because we don't know who these children are, we have no idea who they could be. And that's probably a good thing, but it's also a bit of a mind-blowing thing, because they really could be anyone. That youngest serial killer in South Africa's history I mentioned, they could be anyone too. And the flip side of this is that because these types of records would be sealed, it's even possible that some really violent adult offenders might be on our radars now, and we, as the public, have no idea that they've been committing crimes for many, many years. And in that respect, things start to get a bit worrying, because how do we really know that diversion and the like are working and not just buying time for young offenders to become even more violent adult offenders? I guess we don't know. We just have to hope that's not the case. And really, let's face it, all of this means very little to Isaac Michels, whose young life was brutally cut short in what was perhaps just a moment of childish, poor judgment. Little Isaac's parents sent him to the farm that December to get him out of the Cape Flats and away from the negative influences there. The sad irony is that they could have no idea they were sending him straight into the clutches of exactly the type of danger they were trying to avoid. Isaac Michels, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.